Call the Judiciary Committee to order March 8th, 2011. We're going to go ahead and start out with 2797. And Representative Smith, are you here?
I am.
Would you like to come up?
Sure. Representative Thatcher, may she join?
I guess. I'm in trouble if I say no.
Chairs, members of the committee, House Bill 2797 allows persons to possess firearms while operating motorcycles, all-terrain vehicles, and snowmobiles, so long as firearms are in a locked container or equipped with a device that prohibits the discharge. Permits persons operating snowmobiles to carry unloaded firearm or bow, and if licensed, concealed handguns. There is also a -1 amendment. It refines the definition of unloaded for purposes of carrying a weapon while operating a snowmobile.
Good afternoon, Mr. Co-Chairman. Chair people, chairpersons. For the record, I'm Oregon State Representative Greg Smith, and I have the distinct pleasure of representing Northeast Oregon in Union and Wallowa and Umatilla and Morrow counties. And I'm pleased to come before you today as a sponsor and as a supporter of House Bill 2797. This bill was originally sponsored by Representative Thatcher. I had an opportunity to take a look at this bill and realize that there was a key component of it that was important to me, and that relates to the use of carrying a firearm on ATVs, and that's why I'm here today. I just want to share a quick demographic story with you, if I may. I represent parts of this state that are comprised of 70% national forest, and I represent a part of the state where at times we may have more cows than we do people. And quite often we have hardworking men and women who earn a living off that land. And part of that earning a living is riding all-terrain vehicles or off-road vehicles. And an issue in the last year has come to my attention talking about the capability of having a firearm in those vehicles when they're off-road. And the amendment that we're going to be bringing forward to you would allow that to occur. So what I just want you to know, I'm here to support House Bill 2797. It's a piece of legislation that, from my neck of the woods, makes sense. And I'm going to ask for your support. With that said, I'm going to turn this over to Representative Thatcher, if I may, and then, if it'd be possible, Mr. Co-Chairs, add additional thoughts as we go.
Thank you. Kim Thatcher, Representative from Kaiser, St. Paul, and Newburgh. Why don't they just call me this committee? I would love to just join y'all up there. Anyhow, I know you talked about a similar bill earlier. This one, I think, addresses some loopholes or, I don't know, gaps in the law that I think are unintended. So I call it technical fixes. And one is that under current law, not even a person with a concealed handgun license can carry a loaded firearm while they sit on an ATV or a snowmobile, for that matter. So if you're out in the woods and you're walking along, and then as soon as you get on an ATV, you have to take your gun off, and, you know, it's kind of ridiculous. So it clarifies, it fixes that. It clarifies the law for off-road vehicles in two ways. You have to remember that even if you're just in a pickup, the minute you leave a paved roadway, you're an off-road vehicle and would not, under the law as it is currently, be able to carry. So first, this bill will provide a definition of unloaded, so you can not only transport a handgun safely on an ATV or snowmobile, but you can also have it handy in case you need it to defend yourself or others in your party. And the next thing it does is make it clear that people with the concealed handgun license are exempt from, you know, they can still carry concealed while on these off-road vehicles. And working with Representative Smith, and we merged a couple of ideas. He has you know, worked on the definition of unloaded, mm-hmm. and there's a dash one amendment that should be before you right now, which also adds the language of to include muzzle loading firearms for those who carry black powder mm-hmm. firearms. And another law that needs to be fixed has to do with motorcycles, and the existing law doesn't make it practical, or there's no practical, lawful, feasible way of carrying if you're on a motorcycle. So if you don't have a CHL, it makes it kind of difficult. So that's being fixed. We supposedly did some, well, we did something last session called Senate Bill 603 that defined readily accessible for cars, but they left out language covering motorcycles. So that's going to be fixed in this bill. And I think they're just common sense fixes, and I ask for your support.
Mm-hmm. Committee members, do you have any questions?
I want to thank you for bringing this bill forward. The rifle I had when I hunt the elk does not have a magazine feed, so I have mm-hmm. loose ammunition I have to put in there. So when I would get on an ATV to go farther in the woods, I have to take everything out of that. And
silly.
If I were to come across a dangerous and or delicious animal, it would take me a while to load it back up. So I appreciate this.
Well, Mr. Co-Chairs, we definitely appreciate your willingness to hear this bill and to consider the proposed amendments to House Bill 2797. Thank you.
Okay. Committee members, anyone else have anything on it? I'll let you off easy. Thank you.
Thank you.
How about Rod Harder, Kevin Sterrett, and Heidi? Is it Disrod? Disrod? Any order you want.
Members of the committee, for the record, Kevin Starrett, Oregon Firearms Federation. Those of you who've been around for a while know that the ATV issue is something we've been trying to solve for a long time. And these are just practical fixes that are, I think, are long overdue. 603, you'll recall from last session, was supposed to define readily accessible. And in fact, the original bill did define readily accessible for motorcycles. And that language was removed inadvertently. And I think everybody agrees that that language, I know of no dispute that the language should be in there. And my major concern with having the language be gone is that because it was originally in the bill and then it was removed, there's no question that judges will view that as a deliberate intent of the legislature. As a matter of fact, last week there was a Supreme Court hearing at Willamette University that I was at, and after it was over, they took questions. And I asked the justices about that, and Justice Durham said that's exactly how they'd interpret it, that that was your intent, and that they would view that, they do that remorselessly, is how they put it. Clearly, motorcycle riders should have a lawful way to transport a firearm other than unloaded and carried openly. And I think this bill covers all of those things, and appreciate your support.
Mr. Co-Chair, it's members of the committee. For the record, I'm Rod Harder with National Rifle Association. My testimony will be very brief. Primarily interests today are getting 603 fixed and addressing the ATV issue. Every year, it seems that we have somebody arrested for carrying a firearm on an ATV, unknowingly thinking it was unloaded, ammunition in the clip, nothing in the chamber, but still being cited. So this bill clears that up. The amendment, it very definitely tells when a revolver is unloaded, when a rifle is unloaded, a shotgun is unloaded, and basically what it says is no round is in a position to fire. The amendment that is before you simply adds muzzle loaders to the mix, and it says that there can be no primer in the, you can have powder in it, but no primer. Thank you very much.
Chair Barker and Chair Krieger, my name is Heidi Disrud, and I'm here on behalf of Bike Pack of Oregon. I'm a U.S. Army veteran. I'm an avid hunter. I ride quads and motorcycles, and evidently I've been breaking the law. I am here in support of House Bill 2797, and I would ask for your support. Thanks.
Okay, thank you. Committee, do you have any questions? Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chair, I move the dash one amendments in House Bill 2797.
Okay, Representative Barker moves the amendment dash one into House Bill 2797.
Are we in work session?
No, we're just moving it in.
You still need to be in work session in order to move
it. I'll move it into work session for the purpose of the amendment.
It's not posted.
Okay. Do you want to hold it over?
Yeah.
Okay, we'll hold it over. We'll close the public hearing on 2797. And we want to continue the public hearing we had from yesterday on 3057. We'll open a public hearing on that.
And co-chairs, members of the committee, the continuation of House Bill 3057, which, as you may remember from yesterday, eliminates the statute of limitations for certain crimes involving minors.
Okay, I want to have Letty Merritt and Grid Hatton come up, please.
My name is Letty Merritt. Co-Chairman Barker, Co-Chairman Krieger, and members of the committee, good afternoon. My name is Letty Merritt, and I live in Southwest Portland. I am here to urge you to pass House Bill 3057. I am 41 years old, and I am a survivor of childhood sexual abuse. I was sexually abused by several adult male relatives when I was a little girl. Some of my abuse happened here in Oregon, where I was born and raised. The abuse began when I was 6 years old, and it did not stop until I was 13 years old. I told my mom about the abuse when I was a little girl. As is common in these cases, I was not believed and nothing was done. The sexual abuse continued. I internalized everything. I shut down. I have lived my life on autopilot. I was living but not really present in life. Childhood sexual abuse did that to me. Something inside of me died. I had a hard time trusting others and their motives for fear they would end up hurting me, just like the way my male relatives did. I remember my relationships with school teachers were strained, and as I got older, my work relationships were strained too. I tried to forget about the abuse. I tried to convince myself that the sexual abuse did not damage me. I tried to pretend it never happened. And throughout all of this, I would see these male relatives at family functions growing up. I would have to converse with them at these family functions. I kept living my life within the walls I built to protect myself. And those walls were walls of shame, fear, embarrassment, confusion, despair, and a lot of pretending that I was okay when I really wasn't okay because I didn't know what else to do. This was my painful reality. I was really struggling along to survive in life and found it to be very overwhelming. I graduated from college when I was 29 years old. My life since then has been about trying to catch up for what seems to be years of living on autopilot and of not being present in life. It took until my late 30s to finally feel safe enough to really speak about the sexual abuse and to begin the process of comprehending and acknowledging the enormity of all the devastation caused by the sexual abuse. I still struggle to speak about it, but I am still on my journey of healing. I have seen a handful of psychologists, counselors, and therapists here in Oregon to help me deal with the damages stemming from my childhood sexual abuse. None of these professionals knew about the Oregon statute of limitations, whether civil or criminal. I certainly was not familiar with the Oregon statute of limitations either. I had so much more healing work to do before the words statute of limitations ever meant anything to me. I found my voice through therapy and the passage of time, and by living in a safe haven in my marriage with Ben, who has been my anchor while I continue to deal with the raw emotions and feelings associated with my damaged past. I confronted these male relatives here in Oregon about the sexual abuse when I was 39 years old. Two of the three male relatives apologized to me for sexually abusing me. The other hid behind his alcoholic past and claims he does not remember what he did to me. I painfully remember everything. As soon as I filed a civil lawsuit against them, they recanted their stories and their apologies. The statute of limitations came into play, and I had to dismiss my civil lawsuit against them. In my pursuit of healing and justice, the statute of limitations prevented me from any legal justice ever. But it continues to protect my molesters here in Oregon. I ask this committee for the opportunity for victims like me to be able to seek justice for the crimes perpetrated against us as children. I respectfully ask for your support with House Bill 3057. Thank you. And I will take questions if you have any of me.
We'll wait. Go ahead.
Co-chairs Barker and Krieger and committee. My name is Greg Hatton. I live in Eugene, Oregon. I'm self-employed, and I'm a survivor. Childhood sexual abuse is an awful crime, which is life-changing for everyone. I became a victim in 1971 and buried that memory so deep it took me 35 years to tell my story. Why does it take that long for a victim to speak? That's a question I hope to answer, at least from my perspective. It seems so logical to adults. You have a crime like this, you should speak out. And I didn't. And here's why it took me so long. When I was 13 years old, my father was diagnosed with cancer. My parents went to Houston for 3 months of treatment. I became a victim that summer at the hands of a trusted adult, a youth pastor. And when my parents returned, I almost didn't recognize my father. At that time, in 71, the chemotherapy almost killed you if the cancer didn't. And based on what he was going through, the things that I was going through paled in comparison. So I stayed silent. My father fought cancer for 2.5 years before it killed him. My mother, at that point, had to go to work outside the home for the first time in her life, held down 2 jobs, tried to raise 4 teenagers, And again, based on what she was going through, the abuse that I suffered was a footnote in my mind, and so I stayed silent. Then I shifted into gear. I put myself through college, I got married, I began a career in business, and started a family. We had three kids. I worked hard. I was a very involved father in everything from PTA to youth sports, and I kept a very watchful eye on my kids. And all the time, I became very good at suppressing those memories. Finally, when the last of our three kids left home for college, I gave myself permission to revisit what happened to me in the summer of 71. And it turns out suppressing those events for 30 or 40 years is very common, is what I found out in stepping forward. And one of the things that gave me the confidence to step forward are people like Letty, who would step forward and tell their stories. That gives me a lot of confidence to come forward and strength to tell you what happened. It was so many years after the statute of limitations had expired, I didn't have a case. I didn't have a case I could win. I had a lot of facts, and I had an incredible recollection of minute details about what happened to me in that summer. But I still was so far past the statute of limitations, I didn't have a winnable case, and I knew that. I pursued it anyway because I wanted to tell my story for the record and hopefully help people that didn't have to go through what I went through. So for my deposition, I faced one of the best defense teams in the country. Those guys were very good. They spent an entire day asking me questions that I wouldn't wish on anyone, and I'm glad my wife wasn't there. Whether that was to unnerve me, intimidate me, or just to ask those questions in general, but it was very difficult, and my counsel warned me that this would be the most difficult day of my life, and it was, by far. I also admitted for them, because they asked several pointed questions to get me to articulate that I knew the statute of limitations had long since expired and I really didn't have a case. And, of course, I admitted that for the record. And it occurred to me afterwards that was really the only question they needed to ask. You know, the details about my sex life and everything else, it was almost like window dressing compared to that one question, which I answered for the record. The other thing that occurred to me is it's as if the crime had a shelf life. And once the shelf life expired on the crime, the criminal was innocent and the victim was guilty of taking too much time to come forward and tell the story. So based on that, I was guilty of taking too much time. And there are 100 reasons that I could tell you because it's played over in my mind a million times. I'm going to list you the top, just quickly, the top five. Here's the top five reasons why, at least in my mind, I waited to tell my story. First of all, I was too busy. Work, work, work. I mean, raising kids, having a career, that was always my go-to excuse for not stepping forward. I'm just too busy. I don't have time to deal with this right now. If the thought occurred to me, I would put it aside and I would work harder. So I was busy. My mother. I don't know about your mother, but I have the kind of mother who would take personal responsibility for what happened to me while she was away with my father in Houston. And that weighed heavy on my mind. She'd been through a lot. And it was a factor on not coming forward. I just didn't want to put her through that. My wife and kids, this is my reason number three. I have a great wife, great kids, and there's a chemistry there. And would that become unbalanced if they knew what happened to me in the summer of 71? I don't know. It would certainly alter it, I think, or I thought at the time, and I know they would be very supportive, but still, it's in the back of my mind, is that relationship going to change somehow because of what happened to me? Fourth is my job. I was vice president for Hallmark Cards for years. I had over 2,000 people reporting to me, and then I was senior vice president, chief merchandising officer of Bi-Mart. So I had an entire company looking to me, and my position and the decisions I make and the reputation I have, there's a stigma involved with this. And I couldn't wrestle it to the ground entirely, but it weighed on my decision whether to step forward or not. How are people going to view me as a leader, as a businessman, as a decision maker? That was a factor. Fifth factor was my faith. I'm a Christian, and I was raised turn the other cheek. And I had, let God be the judge of this. And I happen to think, or maybe it's just my fondest wish, that there's a special version of hell for child molesters, and particularly the molesters that have access through the church I just, maybe it's just me trying to rationalize this whole thing, but it's a heinous crime. And so my faith was another factor in the midst of 100 that prevented me, at least crossed my mind, whether I should step forward or not. Now here's what I learned from this entire experience. I learned that every victim has a unique story, and every victim has their own timetable of when it's right to step forward. It might take 4 days, it might take 40 years, but time shouldn't make it less of a crime for the criminal, as it certainly isn't less of a crime for the victim. And one more point. You know, I've heard the concern that this bill will cause possibly a wave of false accusations, and that may be true. But I guarantee you, the defense team that I had, you know, they would ferret that out in about 5 minutes. Very, very thorough, and, you know, that's all I have to say about that. But thank you so much for the opportunity to tell my story, and I ask for your help in supporting 3057. Any questions?
Committee?
Mr. Chair, thanks. Greg and Letty, thank you very much for sharing again. I mean, wow, you guys are strong. Appreciate it. Greg, I guess kind of a neat opportunity for me to ask you, because 2 years ago you really helped us with the civil portion of this, and now we're dealing with the criminal side of it. And I'll just be candid with you. I mean, I'm kind of struggling a little bit with this myself. For extending this portion of it because of the evidence that may have been lost over a long time period, especially when you're moving forward in the criminal side of it being beyond a reasonable doubt versus that of where we're on the civil side for preponderance. I have read stories and articles that when a victim, a survivor, is able to move forward from a criminal side and they have what they believe is solid evidence, a solid case to move forward through the district attorney's office, and then once the DA makes the choice of whether to file or not to file, that in itself has actually opened up the wounds even greater should the district attorney choose not to go that direction. I'm just curious your thoughts if you've walked through this.
Want me to answer? Representative Olson, co-chairs, and committee. The only way I can respond to that is the wound couldn't have been opened any wider than it was in that one day of testimony. I was asked so many questions, and I really I had to take a break a couple times because it was emotional. It was very, very difficult. After that happened, and actually this is the third time I've spoken about it. The second time was a talk you heard me give, but this is literally the third time I've spoken about it in public. And I wouldn't say it's easy, but I think it gets easier, only because I have more clarity of thought. I don't think the wound will ever be healed entirely, but I think for me, I'm able to speak about it more freely than I was before. I think it's that one incident which, once that's out of the way and all those details are behind me, now I can talk about it a little bit more freely. Does that answer your question?
It does.
Okay.
Just follow up then, and just kind of a little different direction. I know a lot of what we had discussion about, and my intent was at least was to open the door for protection for others, maybe with where we were going 2 years ago. Do you see the same element involved here then from the criminal side as well? For, you know, the potential of prevention.
Okay. You want me to answer that? Yes, Representative Olson, co-chairs and committee. That really is maybe a rationalization on my part, but the biggest reason I step forward is to help future survivors, future victims. That's kind of been my mission. Once I knew I had an unwinnable case, then I was all about, okay, how can I take what happened to me and help make it better for the next generation, the next victims that come forward. And so that's what compels me to do what I'm doing today, is to say, can I make that better for someone else? And I think the statute of limitations is a big barrier. I mean, I didn't list it in the top five because I talked about it so much before, but that was a huge limitation for me and a huge barrier to should I step forward or not. it's pointless to step forward because it was so far past the statute of limitations expiration that it was pointless. I mean, that was a voice that I had battled constantly for years, whether to step forward or not. So I think taking that down, I think that helps future survivors deal with it. I really do. Does that answer your question?
It does.
If I may, Co-Chairman Barker, Co-Chairman Krieger, members of the committee, Representative Olson. This was difficult for me to say, but I would be willing to go forward had there not been a statute of limitations to prevent me from going forward against my molesters. So even though I will not personally benefit from House Bill 3057, had someone done this years ago for me, I would be able to benefit from it. So I'm here to help future survivors because there will be others just like me who would wish to have had an opportunity to confront my molesters who are still living here in Oregon and who I fear one day I will run into at the grocery store, at the park, wherever, but I'm willing to face that, and I just wish I had an opportunity. But the statute of limitations prevents me from going forward. Thank you.
Anything further, committee? Well, I thank you very much for your testimony. I know it's difficult, but we appreciate you coming forward.
Thank you.
Thank you. Gail Myers, Tiffany Hams, and Andrea Meyer.
Chair Barker, Chair Co-Chair Krieger, members of the committee, Gail Meyer, on behalf of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. OCDLA would genuinely like to commend the sponsor of the bill in focusing on an effort to ferret out childhood sexual abuse. And I would like to personally extend my appreciation for the two witnesses who just testified before us. It did take great courage. In truth, many of our clients are victims of this crime themselves, and it does have a long and never-ending repercussions through the course of their life. We would submit that really there needs to be a focus on establishing procedures that do promote the prompt reporting of these incidences when they do occur. Prompt reporting serves everybody's interests, societies, the victims, the defendants, the prosecutors, the police, everybody's, the courts. Delay, on the other hand, compromises those interests. And the question really is, what is appropriate in terms of promoting prompt reporting? What have we done to facilitate that? I would submit that we've come a long way since the days of the 50s, the 60s, the 70s, when there was a hostile environment, and perhaps we can do more. But I would encourage the committee that the focus should be on what can we do to promote prompt reporting of these crimes when they occur. Keep in mind that if there is a delay, the offender continues to be out there. When there's a prompt reporting, there can be prompt gathering of evidence and apprehension. Statute of limitations do incorporate foundational principles of due process. The right to a speedy trial is connected to the statute of limitations. The right of the defendant to call witnesses in his or her defense. The right to have compulsory process, to issue subpoenas and bring into the courtroom tangible evidence, documents that establish a particular fact. The right to present the defense itself, to a fair trial, to due process, is all tied to the timing of the trial in relation to the allegation. With increased delay, we impact all those rights. Witnesses die, they move away, they lose memory, or their memory is influenced by after-occurring events, either favorably or disfavorably. evidence is lost or destroyed, discarded, because it's not known to be relevant. So you can't get cell phone records, credit card receipts, lease agreements, anything that would establish who was where when with length of time. This bill does seem to be inspired over rage associated with conduct of former Governor Neil Goldschmidt, but it is much broader than that. This does extend the limitation for juvenile crimes against juveniles, so minor on minor incidences. I understand that the sponsor of the bill is considering an amendment to make it simply apply to adults who offend against minors, but right now it does pick up minor to minor conduct. It does pick up misdemeanor conduct, not just felony conduct. It picks up conduct that is mere touching over the clothing, also consensual sex. It picks up crimes for which there is no forensic evidence that will survive throughout time. I'd like to make two points that I think are very important, and I'd like to stress them. Number one, let me assure those on the committee who are not seasoned veterans of the system, the testimony alone of one witness with no other corroborating evidence, if believed by the jury beyond a reasonable doubt, is sufficient evidence to convict. So I'll say it again. The testimony alone of one witness, even if uncorroborated by any other evidence, if believed by the jury beyond a reasonable doubt, is sufficient to convict. So the longer you tolerate delay, the more probable it becomes that these trials will devolve into the statements, the representations of one person versus another, and we will have lost the ability to pull in any other witnesses or any other documents that would shed light on that allegation. Second point, perhaps it's awkward, but I will say it. Not all allegations are truthful. They are not. Any seasoned veteran has their own stories. I have mine. I'd be happy to share them with you. I noted that the day that the Oregonian printed the article on this bill on Sunday about this bill and its reference to former Governor Goldschmidt, on page 2, it also it's referenced that an ex-student's claim of rape, a George Fox student who alleged that there was a rape of her in her on-campus housing, was proven to be unfounded. So let me assure the committee, these allegations can be false, and it is only through dogged effort and investigation and the ability to patch together witnesses and documents that can shed light. Lucky for George Fox University, they had a prompt ability to get onto that and investigate that. When the system allows delay, and it does evolve eventually to the testimony of one person against the other, I guess the question is that what we want? Is that what we want in our criminal adjudications, where we tolerate delay and we lose the evidence that otherwise existed had the charges been brought more quickly? I've passed out for the committee a chart, and I thought it might be informing for some to take a look at how many times in the past this body has looked at this issue with respect to limitation periods, and particularly with respect to Representative Olson's comments. There was a lot of activity on this in 2009. The legislature addressed it both on the criminal side as well as on the civil side. On the criminal side, the legislature removed the statute of limitation period for your first degree sex crimes, rape one, sodomy, etc., if the defendant had been identified through a DNA sample comparison. This was the first time, other than murder, that the statute of limitation period in crimes had been completely eliminated. And in all candor, OCDLA did oppose that bill, but I do recall the debate, and I do acknowledge to the committee. The committee's responses to our objections were actually sound in this way. When you have murder, you have a dead body that shows evidence of trauma and forcible assault. And And so then there is assurance that a crime actually occurred. The question then becomes who? But society knows there was a crime that occurred in this murder. And so if we extend the statute of limitations, at least we can be satisfied that we know for a fact that a crime occurred. Similarly, the thinking was in 2009, if you have a prompt report of these allegations and DNA is retrieved, that too shows objective forensic proof of criminal conduct. If you have a youth with DNA evidence on it, that's per se evidence of a crime. If you have an adult woman with a prompt allegation of rape and some kind of body indicator of forcible assault, that too is proof of a crime. And so society can feel comfortable in extending the statute of limitation to a degree because they know something occurred. The question is who. That is not this bill. The crimes at issue here can occur through mere speech, luring. The allegation could consist of mere touching. And when we wait 20, 30 years to adjudicate that, how does society really know that something, in fact, occurred? There is no objective forensic proof. Similarly, on the civil side in 2009, this body debated long and hard, do we extend the statute of limitations on civil claims? And this body decided, well, we will stop it at 40 years. 40 years or 5 years from the discovery of the causal relationship between the abuse and the injuries. What then this bill does, 3057, is that it would have the criminal liability leapfrog over civil liability and be greater and more extended. And I would submit that that's usually the flip-flop, the reverse of how normally it is. Recognizing the differences between monetary damages and loss of personal liberty, almost always criminal cases have a shorter limitation period than civil. We would submit that it would be unconscionable to extend the statute of limitation period for crimes beyond that of civil liability without also affording the criminal defendant rights of civil discovery, rights of taking a sworn deposition, rights of subpoenaing records. We do not have those rights. And I have a witness here, Ms. Tiffany Harris, who will be speaking in a moment. She will talk about the differences in discovery between civil liability and criminal cases, but the differences are profound. And if this body is to eliminate the statute of limitations and have criminal liability exceed that of civil, then we submit that criminal defendant must be empowered with the ability to defend themselves in the same way. So again, we'd like to thank the sponsors of the bill. We do submit that the current statutes, which allow for criminal liability up to the age of 30 or within 12 years of the time of reporting of the crime, not the time of the commission of the crime, but 12 years from the date of reporting of the crime, whichever comes sooner, is sufficient. And we should continue to focus on ways that would prompt even more prompt recording, promote more prompt reporting than that. Thank you.
Good afternoon, committee, co-chair Krieger and vice chair Hicks. Thank you. Forgive me if I'm a little nervous. At one point in time, I was sitting where your committee counsel was sitting. Never sat actually on this side of the dais. So bear with me. My name is Tiffany Harris. I am currently in private practice with a small firm downtown. I handle a mix of criminal and civil cases. I started out my law career as a civil litigation associate at Schwabe, Williamson, and Wyatt, and I stayed there for 5 years, and during that time, I assisted in the defense of many, many civil claims based on allegations of sex abuse that were 15, 25, and 35 years old. So I have some experience with the way that the civil pretrial discovery rules operate in that context, and I will tell you that I left that job about 5 years into it, so that would have been about 2007, to go to the public defender's office, which, aside from being a huge difference in pay, was a difference in practice, and I had to learn the criminal rules of discovery. And in one of my first cases, Ms. Meyer is reminding me of one of my first cases, this was an assault case. And the real issue in the case was whether or not the alleged victim had suffered what would be considered an injury for purposes of the assault statute. So I said to myself, of course, coming from a civil background, I know what I'll do. I'll draft up a subpoena that complies with HIPAA. I'll serve it. I'll get a big stack of records delivered to my desk, just the way I would in a civil case, because now I'll be able to find out what was the condition of the alleged victim when she sought medical care. We'll resolve the case in 2 weeks. I've got it figured out. So, of course, I had to be lectured sort of sternly by my supervisor that we don't have pretrial discovery in criminal cases. You can't do that, and if you do that, you're going to get in trouble. And I said, what do you mean? And she explained that you can't just fire off a subpoena and get documentary evidence that would resolve key issues in the case. You have to, in that particular case, you have to ask the court for permission. You have to file a motion that, in some ways, telegraphs your theory of the case because it's a motion that gets served on the other side. And then if the court, in its discretion, decides to grant you permission to issue the subpoena, the records will be delivered to the court. And they won't be delivered in 14 days, which would be the usual timeline. They'll be delivered for you to use when they are being offered in evidence, which would have been the trial date. And, of course, in a civil case, you do all of your work well in advance of trial, and a lot of times that actually helps resolve the case before you even need to have a trial. So after a lot of palpitations, I did figure out a way, because I'm used to looking at statutes and rule books and finding a way for my clients. That's how I was trained. I found a way to get those records at least a little bit earlier than I would have normally been entitled to them. And I am remembering that contained in the medical records was information that was completely unanticipated and that established factually my client's innocence. And I remember making a copy for the prosecutor, and the case was dismissed. But the thing that I want to point out to the committee was that the timelines in terms of pretrial discovery in a criminal case and a civil case are very different. And my client in that case told me, I don't want to plead guilty. I didn't do it. And I said, well, you're in a tough spot because you have a plea offer, but it expires soon. And if you accept the plea offer, you can take some classes. This eventually will come off your record if you can afford to pay for all the classes and finish this over the course of 13 months. Eventually, they'll dismiss the charge, so that's good news for you. And he said, but I didn't do it. And so he was in the position of turning down the plea offer, risking the criminal conviction and jail time. And had those records not contained that sort of silver bullet information, which was unanticipated, he would have had to go to trial. He would have left that plea offer, fairly favorable, behind, and he would have risked what would have been essentially a swearing match between two people because, again, in that case, the alleged injury was so slight that there wouldn't be, you wouldn't be able to have a forensic team come in and say, you know, here are our findings. It would have been a he said, she said case. Now, luckily for him, he was willing to take the risk, felt strongly about his innocence, and we were able to get records on a slightly accelerated timeline that established his innocence and resulted in a dismissal. That was really rare. That was a happy ending. I got lots of pats on the back for being a bookworm and getting those records. But that was exceptional. And so I won't bore down into too many of the details, but to just highlight some of the differences that you have in a civil case versus a criminal case in terms of working up the case and investigating the facts. If I'm litigating a civil case, as soon as a complaint is filed, I can fire off what's called a request for production. I'm sure some of your members can, you know, I know at least a couple of you are members of the civil bar. You can explain this to members if they have questions, but that allows me to get any documents essentially that I ask for that are either relevant to the claim or to the defense. There's a presumption that those records should be produced. Courts, in 5 years of civil practice, I've never had a trial judge say that's irrelevant and it doesn't need to be disclosed. There's a broad and liberal presumption that all of that stuff should be on the table. and available because it helps parties resolve cases. So you get that, you're able to put a timeline on it. I want this in 30 days. And so you get that stuff up front. You get early discovery before your client has to make decisions that imperil his interests. He has a sense of what's out there, what records still exist, how can we get them, are they helpful to us? So that's a key difference. There is a discovery statute in the criminal context, and that essentially requires the state to disclose records that it intends to offer at trial. That is a much more filtered universe of evidence. In a sex abuse case, I have two objectives. Number one, I have to prove my client's innocence because, unlike all of the other criminal charges that can be leveled against a client, an allegation of sex abuse shifts the burden of proof. And any person who has tried one of these cases to a jury will tell you that you are not presumed innocent, you are presumed guilty, which makes it so much more important that if there's evidence out there, it still exists and it's still available. That's my first objective. My second objective is I have to explain why the heck would this person make this up? Or why would this person be mistaken about what happened? Was this person's memory contaminated? Is there some sort of secondary gain here? And that evidence, in my experience in litigating these claims civilly and criminally, well, especially criminally, that's not contained in the evidence that gets disclosed, because the evidence that gets disclosed, and I'm not insinuating that there's any shenanigans on the state side, but the evidence that gets generated on the state side is evidence that will be used to further a prosecution. It's not evidence that would be used to explain, why would this person make this up? How can I prove this person's innocence? That's evidence that I have to go out and find from other sources. So to a large degree, the evidence that I'm entitled to under the criminal statutes in discovery is not evidence that furthers my ability to answer those two questions. How can I prove my client's innocence? How can I explain what the heck happened here? That's not evidence that's contained in things like police reports, which get turned over at the beginning of a case, in a criminal case. That's evidence that I have to get by talking to 10-year-olds sometimes, looking at psych records, looking at text messages, reading Facebook postings, talking to relatives. And again, that's evidence that in a criminal case I may not get to when my client is in the position of contemplating a plea. And so when you're talking about now stripping the statute of limitations away from one of these cases, you are in what I think is an unprecedented position, because now you have a class of people who are going to be subject to claims that are older, who will be facing mandatory minimum prison sentences, and who have fewer rights and less access to pretrial discovery. So I think it's an unprecedented situation, at least for Oregon, to have a criminal statute of limitations that exceeds the civil statute of limitations. And again, in the civil world, we've got a lot of tools that we don't have in criminal cases. One of your witnesses talked about a deposition. A deposition tells me where are the witnesses, where are the papers, how can I use an expert in this case? I get to ask 7 hours worth of questions to a person. There are rules in place to make sure that you don't badger, that you're not inappropriate. The Oregon Bar I find to be sort of the friendliest and most respectful venue to do a civil deposition, but it provides a lot of key information about the underlying facts. You don't have that access in a criminal case. You don't get to take a deposition. You get to serve requests for admission. I can serve on the other side. I can say in 45 days you have to answer all of these questions. You have to either say admitted or denied, and you have to provide detail. And if I don't get that from you in 45 days, I can go to court and everything you left blank will be presumed admitted. So that's a way for us to resolve things. And we would use this in litigating claims of sex abuse that arose decades ago, because it would help us establish, admit that in ninth grade you lived in Astoria. Admit that in 1972
you were in fifth grade. These are things that in a civil case, when you're trying to figure out a chronology, did this person even live where they said they lived? These are all things you have to investigate. You're not going to have school records anymore if the person went to junior high in 1972, especially if it's a public school. Those records are gone. So at least, at the very least, in a civil case, you can cobble together your timeline and your chronology, and you can present a defense sometimes based on tools that you have at your disposal in a civil case that you don't have in a criminal case. And so that's what I was asked to address. I have other concerns with the bill. I don't want to be overly detailed, but I wanted to give the committee a flavor for some of the tools that we have when we litigate civil claims. I think most of my colleagues who still do civil work would say, Tiffany, it's still not enough. Don't create the impression that if you're litigating a civil claim 30 years after it arose, that the civil discovery rules are a panacea, because they're not. But I certainly can't imagine litigating claims that are that old in the criminal context without being able to use those tools. And so I will just end with one more thought, which is that as a young litigation associate, I did have a chance, because I would attend depositions and I would meet victims or people who were alleging a claim of sex abuse alleged to have occurred a long time ago, and I got a flavor of how their lives had gone. And I got to hear a lot about how they grew up, the schools they attended, the youth groups they were involved in, and the culture that existed back in those days. And I can tell you that it is a different world today, and that Oregon has really been a leader in changing the very conditions that existed to keep people in silence for so many years, that we have really come light years. And I know this just having been privy to those details. And so I would ask you as a committee to consider the fact that this bill, it certainly won't change the fact that there were people who sort of suffered in silence and grew up in conditions where they didn't feel safe to make a report of abuse. And when, as a committee, you are asked to consider how best to use limited resources, I would submit to you as a committee that the best use of those resources would be to make sure that we have family settings, school settings, and other settings where people can come forward and litigate these claims in a way that's timely and fair, and not at the expense of something like the statute of limitations, which is such a cornerstone in terms of balancing things out and keeping the system intact and fair to everybody. Thank you.
Andrea, I want to let you have what time you need, but we are
very short, getting long. Yep.
Co-chairs, members of the committee, Andrea Mara, Legislative Director for the ACLU of Oregon. I have very little to add, but and I'm sorry, yesterday I had to leave early and I missed what undoubtedly was also powerful testimony. And this is the hardest type of issue for me to appear on the opposite side of folks who have real life experiences that are heartbreaking. But we do respectfully appear today in opposition to House Bill 3057 for the reasons well articulated by others. It is a due process issue. It is the reason we have statute of limitations, which is to provide the necessary safeguards, not to protect the guilty, but to protect the innocent. And when we remove it, or by having it rather, the existence of a statute of limitation, it allows in the criminal process both the prosecution and the defense to present their case before the evidence gets stale. And it allows the accused to call witnesses and prepare a defense. And as you've heard, as more time lapses between the crime and the trial, it becomes increasingly difficult, if not impossible, for the accused to prepare a meaningful defense. Memories are lost. Witnesses have died. Exculpatory evidence, if you can even get a hold of it, is no longer available. So for those reasons and the reasons already articulated, we respectfully urge the committee not to proceed with House Bill 3057. Thank you.
Committee members, do you have any questions for Representative Olson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It can be for any one of you. Did you get a chance to listen to the response from Kelly Clark, my question to him yesterday, that dealt with the issue involving the district attorney being involved for determining where to file or not to file. I'm just curious what your thoughts are on that. I mean, basically, because if we were to move forward with this bill and make it law, it would be the DA who would make the call. So I'm just curious your thoughts.
Thank you. Co-chairs Barker and Krieger and Representative Olson. This is Gail Meyer. I have two thoughts. One is district attorneys have a lot of discretion and authority now, and it would, in my view, almost be an abdication of decision-making of this body to simply empower them to make these choices in all instances of what is a case worthy of pursuing and for how long. That's my first thought. My second thought's more concrete. I think it puts, I'm not a district attorney, and I understood their position yesterday, but I think it puts district attorneys in a very compromised position. If they were to have a 60-year-old woman come forward and say, my stepfather abused me for years, and my mom is now dead, and so now I want to prosecute him. He is in a retirement home in Florida, but I want you to extradite him and bring him in. And he's in poor health, but I want to press charges. And then the district attorney's in a position of saying, whoa, he's infirm, he lives in Florida, he's in a retirement home, he's probably not a current public safety risk, and it will be very expensive to bring him back for a trial that will be her word against his, and if we do get a conviction, he goes to the Department of Corrections for a very long time and dies there after a lot of medical care. And I could see a prosecutor thinking, this isn't the sort of case where we would really want to invest those kind of resources. But I think it puts a district attorney in a very compromised position to make those decisions based on that. So I think that when you remove the statute of limitations, I think that's a statement from the legislature to everyone else downstream, law enforcement, prosecutors, courts alike. Treat all of these seriously. We want all of these to be taken seriously. And I think this has the potential to make future costs associated with this very large. I think it's akin to PERS in that respect. It may not be immediately apparent its expenses, but throughout time, as you get these delayed claims, you start bringing people into the system and have them serve Measure 11 sentences, it will start to balloon.
Committee members, Representative Barker.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. I wish, Mr. Head, that I had your confidence there would be a special place in hell for those people. I can find a place for them in prison, though, here, and I'll try to work to do that. I would like to see this bill move forward, but we certainly need some amendments to take out some of the things that were mentioned here, the juvenile, the minor crimes, the touching, and so on. Why doesn't it, you know, we're talking about children need to inform sooner. You know, I ran across these cases. Fortunately, I never was actually assigned to work that unit, but I dealt with these things. And when a little girl tells her mother that she's being sexually abused, and the mother will turn her down because she wants to keep the worthless guy in the house and continue the abuse, the little girl, what's the little girl, who's she going to turn to? And when the youth pastor at St. Pedophilia's abuses a little boy, you're asking that little boy to go against his religion, his family, and everything else, and it's overwhelming. These kids cannot do that. Or when the funny uncle says, I'm going to kill you, I'm going to kill your mommy and daddy if you talk, you better not talk. So that's some of the reasons children aren't coming forward. And if you have a jury trial, juries are, I mean, unless we're going to say juries are so stupid, I mean, I hear this argument from either side, we're going to say they can't figure things out, so we better not have juries, let's just have judges decide, which none of us want, I would think. Juries can take a look at the witness, juries can take a look at who's saying what, and have a consideration. The George Fox case that was mentioned, the police exonerated that case. And when we talked about evidence, when there was talk about evidence, that you only get a certain amount of evidence from police what they're going to use in prosecution. Should you find out that that district attorney is hiding evidence, what happens after the case? It's thrown out. That's exculpatory evidence they have to disclose to you. You don't have to disclose things to the prosecution. And it's nice that you get 7 hours to take a deposition. And when I go to Mr. Hicks and I say, Mr. Hicks, I want to depose, I'm Jeff Barker, the policeman, I want to talk to you. And he says, pound sand, I'll get an attorney. I'm not telling you anything. That's the end of our conversation. And that's all the information the state gets. Obviously, this takes me back to my previous employment. And the thought to compare the price of PERS to the thought of a little three-year-old getting raped, I'm having trouble connecting those two. And I don't mind paying, and I don't think people outside this building mind paying money to put people like this in prison. It is expensive. But the only time I hear people talking about letting violent criminals out to save money is inside these walls of this building. I don't hear that from people on the other side of this window. So with that,
okay. Any further questions, stop. Committee? Okay, thank you. There is one other person signed up on there, and three of us have looked at the signature, and we cannot figure out if it's a bird sitting on a limb or what it is. Who else signed up for this bill?
I think it was Representative Smith.
Oh, God. Is that a joke, or are you?
We had Greg Smith up on the other one. I can't figure out where it is. I'll have to find out if that's his signature. We are running out of time, so we are going to close the public hearing on 3057. And Representative Barker, Co-Chair Barker, we need to get together and talk about what we need to do with this bill.
We will.
I'm going to vote yes right now, Mr. Chair.
We'll get it cleaned up so everybody...
We'll get it taken care of. I want to open up a work session on House Bill 2439.
Chairs and members of the committee, House Bill 2439, right off the bat, we have no fiscal statement, so we wouldn't be able to move through the floor today unless the committee elected to suspend the rules requiring that the fiscal impact and revenue impacts were available. I can review the bill. Anyway,
or review the bill briefly, and then we'll go ahead and move it over. We got till the time we do have the revenue impact.
There is no revenue impact, but as I said, the fiscal hasn't yet issued. There is no subsequent referral. It was previously heard on February the 23rd. It increases the damages for taking certain game mammals from 800 to 1,000 and deems the damages stated in ORS 496-705 as the value of the wildlife for purposes of certain crimes. There's no amendment. We discussed the provisions of the measure and the poaching. The increase in damages is to permit the taking of these non-trophy mammals to be prosecuted as a higher level at a higher level than what's currently available. That's the point of raising the amount of damages.
Representative Barker, that was your bill?
Yes, and what that covers is the value of the crime moved up, and we did move the value of the dangerous and or delicious animals up, so this will take care of that.
What we'll do, because we don't have the impact statement, let's close the public hearing on 2439.
Work session, excuse me.
And we'll get back to it as soon as we get the paperwork that we need. We're going to go to House Bill 2787. We'll open a work session on that.
Chairs, members of the committee, House Bill 2787, there's no revenue impact, no fiscal impact on the dash ones. It was previously heard on February the 9th. It's the bill that prohibits a public body from disclosing identifying information about persons who are applying for a license to carry concealed handguns absent a court order in a pending case unless it's necessary for a criminal justice purpose. There were dash one amendments received today that have yet to be summarized. But I do know that the Mr. Representative Chair kindly submitted a copy of the intent of his amendment was to replace the measure with a measure from 2009, which was 2787, in its final form as it had progressed through the previous session. There are also -2 amendments which permit disclosure from one public body to another when necessary for a criminal justice purpose and with an applicant or licensee's consent. At the previous hearing, the circumstances of the underlying Court of Appeals case were discussed, licensee's desire for confidentiality, especially crime victims, the non-carrying community's desire to know who is armed, whether to create exceptions for victims of crime, and harm caused by weapons and certain terms of the bill.
Representative Barker, have you had any conversation regarding the other amendments?
I know the -2 I know about that would allow the agency to agency information shift.
Okay. You want to make a motion?
I move the -2s into House Bill 2787.
Representative Barker moves the -2 amendments into House Bill 2787. Any discussion?
Yes. Thank you.
Representative Tomei?
I'm sorry, I looked at these earlier, but I'm just wondering so. The disclosure is to another public body only for criminal justice purposes or for some kind of litigation. Is that true?
Yes, it allows so different police departments could exchange the information if they needed to.
Further follow-up, please?
Follow-up.
So what about, say, in a foster home situation that the DHS might want to know if someone has a concealed gun permit? Would that be permissive to go to that share information?
Yeah, please. Chair, as Representative Tomei, that's still allowed as the bill is written. There is a provision that allows a court order in any pending case, which would be civil or criminal. So a person could motion, and a court would make that determination in a different kind of case.
Follow-up? So, but what you're saying, what if I were a DHS worker, and I just routinely asked that of a potential foster parent? Without getting a court order, I wouldn't have any notion as a DHS worker someone would have a concealed gun permit.
You could ask them, but yeah, you wouldn't have actually they wouldn't have to show you the records.
So, if I can follow up,
yeah, sure, please,
Mr. Chair, Representative Tomei, the bill as it's written requires there be a pending case. That may be meaning that a case has been filed. So, if there's no pending case in which the petition would be filed seeking this information, that there isn't any provision that addresses when a case doesn't exist and there's no case in court, no pending case. It only applies to pending cases.
Right. So, I just want to clarify. So, if I'm a DHS worker, there's no pending case, I don't have a right to ask that information.
You can ask the person. I guess they could lie to you if they were so inclined, but you need to keep in mind that many homes in Oregon have guns that don't have these licenses, so there's no record of that at all. So.
Right. Yeah. But follow up. Me. But if I were the DHS worker and I'd be going to the home, I wouldn't see perhaps a concealed gun permit. I might see if someone has hunting rifles or whatever. Do you see what I mean? But that maybe if there were a concealed gun, it might not be available for anyone to see, correct?
Right. Hey, Representative Hicks.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Tomei, it sounds like the circumstance you're describing would be an assessment of a prospective foster home, and those are done pursuant to an ongoing civil case, a DHS case. And DHS goes in, typically, to evaluate whether a child should be placed pursuant to a civil case, and they haven't actually placed the child until the case has been resolved. I mean, my reading of the explicit statute is, from what I'm gathering, I think the situation you're describing would be covered. I mean, it's a pending civil case. If I'm understanding the concern, which is the DHS, maybe I'm not understanding the concern.
Yeah,
but
may I clarify?
Okay.
So I'm a DHS worker, and I've got a child that's been in a succession of homes.
Indeed.
So there isn't a pending case. This kid is in the custody of Human Services. Right. So if I'm going to place a child, I'd want to know if there were any firearms there, either concealed or openly possessed. Right?
Chair's Representative Tomei, if I may, and I see that for Senator
Shaw. No, go ahead first.
I believe that DHS, when it is active on its case, has the right to compel a court to hear an issue and can go and petition, can initiate a court having a hearing on a particular issue. And so Representative Hicks is correct. Even if there's not an active ongoing pending case, DHS, if it's taking care of the child and has a legal right to ask on behalf of the child, can initiate a case.
Follow-up? So having worked for DHS, having placed children in foster homes, it would never occur to me to go to court to get that kind of order. But it seems to me that would be appropriate for a caseworker to know if a child is being placed in a home where there are firearms.
I would make the comment that possession of firearms is a constitutional right, and it is not part of the criteria of making the determination of the righteousness of that person's home being adequate. We went through this with DHS, Senator Burdick and I think back in 2005. We had group meetings on that, and that is not one of the things they're supposed to be considering if it's a constitutional right issue. In other words, someone's got a firearm in their house that doesn't qualify them. I would say that probably 3/4 of the best citizens in the state got a firearm in a house. How many people here have a firearm in their house? I do. I've had 12 foster kids, and I've never had a problem, nor was I ever asked. It's if there was illegal conduct in the person's background with a weapon, I would want to know. And they can do background checks on the foster parents, and they do that. And that's where it would come out, is if they had been picked up for some charge, DUI, even might endanger a child, in other words, using alcohol excessively, mm-hmm. if you've got them in the car with you, all of those type of things, they do question.
I can, if I may.
Sure.
I can appreciate all that. I guess what I'm saying, I was hoping that this amendment would make it possible for one public body to require that information from another public body. And that's not what I'm seeing this.
No,
it seems to me you've got to go through court to get that information.
Anything further?
Over to Mr. Chair.
Okay, we have a motion for the -2 amendments to go in. We've had a discussion on it. Is there anything further on the -2s?
Mr. Chair, I believe the bill is better with the -2s than without, so I will support the adoption of the -2s. I would have preferred to see a different amendment that would address the larger issue that Representative Tomei is getting to, but my sense of the committee is that that's not going to happen, so I will support the -2s, but will likely be, I may be a no vote on the floor as amended.
Okay. Anything further? Okay, we'll put the -2s are in. Barker, do you want to make a motion?
Move we send House Bill to the floor, House Bill 2787 to the floor with a new pass recommendation. As amended.
Okay, Representative Barker moves House Bill 2787 to the floor as amended. Clerk, call the roll.
Do we already have the -2s into the bill?
No.
Just did.
Just the -2s. That's just what we just
-2s.
Did.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah. Any discussion further on the bill?
No, I'm okay. Thanks.
Can you call the roll?
Representative Nolan?
No.
Representative Olson?
Yes.
Representative Schaffler?
Aye.
Representative Tomei?
May I just make a statement?
Yes.
Thank you. I think this improves the bill, but I still may vote against the bill, even with the amendment. Thank you.
What's your vote on this?
Representative Wong?
Aye.
Representative Wisniak?
Aye.
Co-Vice Chair Hicks?
Aye.
Co-Vice Chair Garrett?
No.
Co-Chair Krieger?
Aye.
Co-Chair Barker?
Aye.
Did I vote yes?
It was kind of up in the air, wasn't it? Okay, House Bill 2787 passes to the floor,
Carol,
with the amendment.
Do you want to vote yes?
No, and I voted yes on the amendment. I thought
she wants to vote no on
that. I'm totally confused. I thought we were voting on the amendment.
We did that, and it passed without objection.
The
question came up on the bill itself with a due pass recommendation. That's the roll call vote.
Okay, then I'm sorry. Can I rescind? I did want to vote no. I was voting
we'll open,
yes on the amendment. Sorry.
House Bill 2787. And do you want a committee to allow her to reconsider the vote?
Yes.
No problem?
I'll vote no.
Okay, the bill still does pass, and it goes to the floor with a new pass. Representative Barker, do we want to have Representative Thatcher, would you like to carry, and we'll back you up? Okay.
Everybody back up.
Open work session on House Bill 2792.
Mr. Chairs, members of the committee, House Bill 2792 has no fiscal and no revenue impacts on the Dash 1 version. There's no subsequent referral. It's previously heard on February the 9th. This is a bill that provides non-residents who are authorized to carry concealed handguns in another state with the protections provided to persons in Oregon who have a concealed handgun license. The issues that came up at the previous hearing were that there are a patchwork of state laws regarding whether to honor another state's license, the requirements, if any, that vary from state to state. An analogy to a driver's license being issued in one state, it's recognized in all states. And the design of this particular statute being the preferred, or this particular bill being the preferred one, because no fiscal impact so long as other states' licenses are honored outright without requiring law enforcement to check and compare against Oregon's requirements. That's what generates a fiscal. And then whether persons refused a license in Oregon would simply obtain a license from elsewhere. Those are the issues.
So there's no fiscal on it now?
Correct. No fiscal impact and no revenue impact. On the Dash 1.
I'll put the Dash 1 in there.
Mr. Chair, I move the Dash 1s into House Bill 2792.
Representative Barker has moved the Dash 1 amendments into House Bill 2792. Discussion on the amendments?
If I may?
Yes,
Representative. So as it says in the mission summary, or the bill summary, Oregon construes a failure to have a license on the person as evidence that no license exists, right? So I just want to make sure that that is as I understand it. If somebody from out of state has a license in another state, but they don't carry that license with them, then it's the same as not.
That's
all right.
Right.
Thank you.
And I apologize, Chair, Representative Tomei, I failed to summarize the Dash 1s. Dash 3s were also received today and have yet to be summarized. So.
Okay. Any further on the Dash 1s? Okay, they're put into the bill.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2792 to the floor to do pass.
As adopted.
As adopted, with as amended.
And Representative Barker moves House Bill 2792 as amended to the floor with the due pass.
Mr. Chair,
Representative
had
Dolan.
We previously adopted the Dash 1 amendment into 2792?
No.
So we are moving.
We just did a minute ago and I dropped the gavel. We had a discussion on the amendments.
Okay.
Dash 1.
And then he put them in. No one objected. Then he made a motion on the amended bill to the floor with a due pass.
Okay.
Don't pay attention. Chair, we go quick.
I'm paying attention. Let's be sure that we are clear for members of the committee and those who are watching exactly what we're doing so that we don't miss a motion.
That's fine.
Deliberately or inadvertently, please.
I'd never do it deliberately.
I try to move things when they're not ready, so I plead guilty to your charge.
Record.
Yep.
Any discussion on the move to the floor?
Mr. Co-Chair.
Representative Nolan.
My reading of the bill as amended is that it cedes the authority of this legislature to legislatures in other states. It allows other states' legislatures to set standards for conduct that occurs within our state borders. That, to me, is a substantial limitation and problem with the bill. I am concerned about allowing other states to set the standard for what will happen within our boundaries, and for that reason, I will be opposing the bill.
I might mention that it only has to do with firearms laws and concealed carry, and we are going to be recognized in those other states just like we recognize other driver's licenses and a whole host of other licenses without the criteria being the same. It's a common practice. Okay, you want to call the roll?
Representative Nolan?
No.
Representative Olson?
Aye.
Representative Shopler?
Aye.
Representative Tomei?
No.
Representative Wong?
Aye.
Representative Wisnam?
Aye.
Co-Vice Chair Hicks?
Aye.
Co-Vice Chair Garrett?
No.
Co-Chair Krieger?
Aye.
Co-Chair Barker?
Aye.
Okay, House Bill 2792 as amended has moved to the floor with a due pass. And why don't you and I carry that bill? That'd be all right? Okay. And we'll close the work session on 2792. And we don't have anything else before the committee, do we? Okay, and we'll be adjourned.